Chuck Coughlin, greeting you again on BreadboxMedia.com. And on my latest attempt to set the record straight, this time in the contest, and it's a false contest, between science and religion. I'm examining science and discovering that my worst fears have been realized, that much of modern science is fraudulent. The true great ideal of the pure scientist has been destroyed by the decay of the outer culture. Because scientists, human scientists, are woven into the human culture, are part of the fabric, is subject to the condition of the human culture. And culture can debase you or it can exalt you. It depends on the condition of that culture. Now, some people find Breadbox Media to contain opinions, powerful opinions, that are sometimes not in the center, but out on the edge. So the theme of this podcast, that most of modern scientific articles in peer-reviewed journals are fraudulent, may sound edgy, not in the rational, calm mainstream, but you'd be wrong. Most scientists are very aware of this, that there's a lot of fraud going on in modern science. Let's examine why. I'm not a scientist myself, but I'm well acquainted with members of the scientific community. One of them is my son. They talk about it a lot. They're aware of it. It worries them. I'm not the first to say the things I'm saying. It's just that the general populace is not aware of them, and they need to be said again. Now, you may find something surprising a little further on in this podcast. Toward the end of this podcast, I'm going to bring in some interesting little parables, some little tales that you might enjoy, but also illustrate what it is that can keep science honest and productive. They will illustrate the point that in the search for the truth, we are aided by imagination and poetry, as well as the elegant and cold rationality of the scientific method itself. So in about 15 minutes, we'll come to that. As I demonstrated in part one of this series, fraud is destroying science. There are many reasons to believe. The majority of articles published in peer-reviewed journals contain conclusions and descriptions of experiments that cannot be replicated by others. Replication is a term that means repeated by others with the same processes and conditions and producing similar or the same results. It's discouraging to discover that they often do not replicate exactly or even approximately the results of the original experiment. No matter how exactly the conditions and processes of the experiment are reconstructed, they come out with different results in the majority of cases. Which is right. The experiment is described in the article, or the attempts to replicate it. Perhaps they're both wrong. And it leads to the question of the individual soul of the scientist must be extremely self-critical and honest and conscious of the great watcher and the great protector. Because, as that proto-modern man said, I'm talking about Nietzsche, God is dead. Well, if God is dead, then what's permissible? Anything is permissible. What do you want to do? You want to publish an article showing positive results? Well, that can be arranged without very much trouble. Nobody's going to check you. That's the way it works. And you can retain your position at the university, your professor's chair, your grant money, and get more. If you produce the right results, by right I mean results that align with the desires of those who give you money, who fund your research. All these thoughts converge upon this odd moment at which I sit here talking to you, this odd moment that we live in. Because the science of past centuries seems to have been rather well done by mainly extremely religious men such as Sir Isaac Newton, Gregor Mendel, Louis Pasteur, the Daily Communicant. So this is an odd moment when the sciences seem to be crumbling along with the rest of our culture. We live in a moment in which an ever more bloated scientific bureaucracy churns out masses of research results, the majority of which seem to be outright false. In our culture, scientists are lauded as heroes. Science itself is upheld as the only legitimate basis for policymaking, religion being defunct. Well, the use of science as a basis, replacing tradition and traditional moral values that developed within Christendom, allows him to be redefined as necessity requires, or as desire requires, or as efficiency requires. As we know, placing efficiency as a primary goal
has permitted us to justify many things, such as euthanasia and abortion. Very efficient.
These moral values were received from God. They're not changeable. And we may be living in a time where many people, and some scientists,
are still guided by moral codes they inherited from Christendom, although the parentage is forgotten and no longer acknowledged. They think it came from our individual virtue. Man is more flawed than that. He cannot walk alone.
So if science is upheld today as the only legitimate basis for policymaking, there's reason to believe that these phenomena are linked. When a formerly ascetic discipline suddenly attains a measure of influence, it's bound to be flooded by opportunists and charlatans, whether it's the National Academy of Science or the Monastery of Cluny. Now, I'm not trying to be funny. This is not an outrageous comparison.
Comparing the National Academy to the monastery.
Just like monasticism, science is an enterprise with a superhuman aim whose achievement is forever beyond the capacities of the flawed humans who aspire toward it. The best science know that they must practice a sort of mortification of the ego and cultivate a dispassion that allows them to report their findings, even when those findings might mean the dashing of their hopes, the drying up of their financial resources, and the loss of their professional prestige. It should be no surprise that even after
demolishing the monasteries during the English Protestant Reformation
and stealing areas as big as a fifth of the land area of England, followed by persecution and torturous death of all the clergy they could find, and the shameful buying off of some. Unfortunately, when science left the monastery, it left honor and true science behind. In the monasteries, the practice of science has attracted souls driven to seek the truth, regardless of personal costs, and despite, for most of its history, a distinct lack of financial or status reward.
It was a good way to go. The monks lived ascetic lives. They didn't marry, they were chaste, they didn't have children who needed braces and care and an inheritance. So monasticism and monk scientists existed in a kind of perfect academic atmosphere, not totally free of concern of status and all. But as they prayed the hours, as they chanted the hours, they were always reminded to be humble in the face of mysteries, to never think they knew what they did not know. But let's talk about the scientific community of today. Science, and especially the bureaucracy of science, is a career, and one amenable to social climbing. Careers attract careerists. Let me quote Paul Carl Feyerabend. He was a professor at the University of California, a philosopher of science. He often criticized scientific orthodoxies of today. He has some interesting quotes on that subject. Here's one quote. "The separation of state and church must be complemented by the separation of state and science. That most recent, most aggressive, and most dogmatic religious institution. Science is not sacrosanct. The mere fact that it exists is admired as results is not sufficient for making it a measure of excellence. Modern science arose from global objections against earlier views and rationalism itself. The idea that there are general rules and standards for conducting our affairs, affairs of knowledge included, arose from global objections to common sense." One of Feyerabend's most biting criticisms of scientific careerists is this. He said they are devoid of ideas, full of fear, intent on producing some paltry result so that they can add to the flood of inane papers that now constitutes scientific progress in many areas. So in the idealized view of scientific progress, it goes like this. New theories are proposed to explain new evidence that contradicts the predictions of old theories. The heretical philosopher we've been talking about, Feyerabend, claimed, on the other hand, that new theories frequently contradict the best available evidence. at least at first. Often the old observations were inaccurate or irrelevant. And it was the invention of a new theory that stimulated experimentalists to go hunting for new observational techniques to test it. But the success of this unofficial process depends on a blithe disregard for evidence, while the vulnerable young theory weathers an initial storm of skepticism. Yet, if Feyerabend is correct, and an unpopular new theory can ignore or reject experimental data long enough to get its footing, how much longer can an old and creaky theory, buttressed by the reputation, influence, and political power of hundreds of established practitioners, continue to hang in the air, even when the results upon which it is premised are exposed as false? The self-praising accounts of science are full of songs to the self-correcting, self-healing nature of its enterprise. But if raw results are so often false, the filtering mechanisms so ineffective, and the self-correcting mechanisms so compromised and slow, then science's approach to truth may not even be monotonic. Now, what do we mean monotonic? Well, that is that past theories, now refuted by evidence and replaced with new approaches, may be closer to the truth than what we think now. The past could be closer to the truth than what we think now. Such regress has happened before. One example is in the 19th century, the correct vitamin C deficiency theory of scurvy was replaced by the false belief that scurvy was caused by proximity to spoiled foods. That was scientific regress. Many ancient astronomers believed the heliocentric model of the solar system. The planets revolve around the sun, heliocentric, before it was replaced by the geocentric theory of the Greek philosopher Ptolemy. So after centuries of believing in the erroneous theories of Ptolemy, a man named Copernicus was a minor Catholic cleric, came up with the theory and the calculations to support it, that the planets revolved around the sun. So we return to the heliocentric concept, which was over 70 years later supported by Galileo Galilei. We return to where we started after a period of scientific regress. You know, there's a term that the British use, the Whiggish theory of history. It's an insulting term, pejorative. It means a history that explains the past in terms of an inevitable progress through time. So in the history of science, it would mean that it focuses on the successful chain of theories and experiments that led to present-day science, while ignoring failed theories and dead ends. That's Whig history. Whig history has many similarities with the Marxist-Leninist theory of history, which presupposes that humanity is moving through historical stages to the classless, egalitarian society to which communism aspires. It puts its faith in the power of human reason to reshape society for the better. It proposes the inevitable progress of humankind. It just does not work that way. So, this Whiggish view of scientific history is so dominant today that the possibility that it is not so, that we do regress at times, is spoken of only in hushed whispers. We don't want to recognize that ours is a world in which things once known can be lost and buried. And even if self-correction does occur and theories move along a life cycle from less to more accurate, what if the unremitting flood of new, mostly false results pour in faster, too fast for the frozen and compromised truth-discerning mechanisms of science to operate? The result could be a growing body of true theories, completely overwhelmed by an even larger thicket of baseless theories, such that the proportion of true scientific beliefs shrinks, while the absolute number of them, of all scientific theories, continues to rise. You may know the wonderful short stories of that South American author, Jorge Luis Borges. He wrote what are sort of philosophical parables. There's one of them that illustrates what we've been talking about here. It's called Funes the Memorius. Funes is a young man who, falling on his head from a horse, becomes strangely crippled. His memory hyperdevelops. He's deprived of any ability to forget. He remembers everything. His mind becomes a monstrous garbage dump
cluttered and clogged with irrelevant data, a gigantic heap of unrelated images and disconnected instants. He cannot evacuate any fragment of past experience, however trifling. This relentless capacity for absolute and continuous recollection is, of course, a curse. It excludes all possibility of thought, for thinking requires space in which to forget, to select, to delete, and to isolate what is significant. If you cannot discard any item from the memory store, you cannot abstract and generalize. But without abstraction and generalization, there can be no thought. There can be no thought. Now, the historian does not merely record. He edits, he omits, he judges, he interprets. History does not record events. It records the echoes of events. It'd be more accurate to say that it records a selection of the echoes of events. But who's doing the selecting? Do we select only those events that fit our theories? You know what that's called, confirmation bias. There seems to be a lot of that operating here, doesn't there? Poor science, suffering under the modern religion of self. The unwatched self, and thus the unprotected self, not protected from the self by a knowledge of God, a particular kind of knowledge, by the sensation of his divine eyes upon us, a feeling of being watched. We need that. The scientist needs that. Therefore, science needs it. Science needs to be protected from scientists. We're talking about selecting information, selecting data to contribute to the truth. And it has to be done with wisdom. It has to be done with attention to what is significant. And sometimes that means ignoring the insignificant. The opposite of that is really illustrated by Funes. Borges' character, Funes, the young man who fell from a horse, and his memory became unselective. Ah, Borges. There's another Borges philosophical parable about a library that contained all the books with the true facts and all the books with the false facts. And therefore it was useless, because there was more false facts than true facts. So if you tried to do your research there and did it thoroughly, you would end up confused. There's another story that I really like that sort of illustrates some of this. And by the way, you know that Plato's dialogues remain the cornerstone of all Western philosophy, and a lot of them are short philosophical parables, because myth is the oldest and richest form of fiction. It performs an essential function. C.S. Lewis said, "What myth communicates is not truth, but reality. Truth is always about something. Reality is what truth is about." Often you find in the Eastern Hemisphere, the ancient Taoist thinkers in China express their ideas in the same kind of imaginative forms. There's one tale in Li Zi that seems illuminating and fundamental to what we're talking about, to paying attention to what is important. Here it is. In the time of the Warring States, horses were very important for military reasons. The feudal lords employed the services of experts to find good ones. Best of all was the super horse, Quan Li Ma, an animal which could run 1,000 miles a day without leaving tracks and without raising dust. Super horses were most sought after, but they were also very rare and hard to detect. Hence the need for highly specialized experts. Most famous among these was a man called Bole. Eventually, Bole became too old to pursue his field trips, prospecting for super horses. Thus his employer, the Duke of Qin, asked him if he could recommend another expert to carry on the task. "Yes," said Bole, "I have a friend, a peddler of firewood in the market, who is quite a connoisseur of horses." Following Bole's advice, the Duke dispatched this man on a mission to find a super horse. 3 months later, the man returned and reported to the Duke, "I have found one. It is in such and such a place. It's a brown mare." The Duke set off his people to fetch the animals.
which proved to be a black stallion, not a brown mare. The Duke was not happy in summoned Bolle. That friend of yours, he does not seem to be much of an expert. He could not even get the animal's sex and color right. On hearing this, Bolle was amazed.
Bolle exclaimed, "Fantastic! He's even better than myself. 100, 1,000 times better than myself. What he perceives is the innermost nature of the animal. He looks for and sees what he needs to see. He ignores what he does not need to see. Not distracted by external appearances, he goes straight to the inner essence. The way he judges horses shows that he should be the judge of more important things than horses."
And needless to say, this particular animal proved to be a super horse indeed, a horse that could run 1,000 miles a day without leaving tracks and without raising dust. You think this is an irrelevant 2,300-year-old Chinese parable? Reflect on it a while. But first, let me tell you another more contemporary story, more close to our time. This one actually happened. There's a man named Claude Bernard. He's a great pathologist whose research and discoveries were of immense importance in the development of modern medical science. So one day, he was on his way into a lecture hall where he was about to teach a class and noticed something peculiar on various trays that were on the table containing different human organs. On one of the trays, flies had gathered. A common mind would have made the common observation, perhaps deploring a lack of cleanliness in the room or instructing the janitor to keep the windows shut. But Bernard's was not a common mind. He observed that the flies had gathered on one particular tray, the one that contained livers. Livers. And he thought, there must be sugar there. And he discovered the glycogenic function of the liver, a discovery that proved decisive for the understanding and treatment of diabetes. He did something. He made a leap. He made sort of a cognitive leap to understand that. One of my favorite poets, the modern poet, the great Catholic Paul Claudel, commented on this story. Here's what Paul Claudel said. "This mental process is identical to that of poetical writing. The impelling motion is the same, which shows that the primary source of scientific thought is not reasoning, but the precise verification of an association originally supplied by the imagination." So that when we refer to poetry, we're taking this word in its most fundamental sense. Samuel Johnson, in his huge English dictionary, assigns three definitions to the word poet in decreasing order of importance. First is an inventor, second an author of fiction, and last is the writer of poems. Because truth is grasped by an imaginative leap, like Paul Claudel said. It's thus not reasoning, but the precise verification of an association originally supplied by the imagination. The imagination. Friends, there are so many stories I could tell you. Some of them that are nonfiction, are true, are real. Some of them are fiction, or maybe myth, and more true than the real ones. I feel in me a want to tell you these stories that are about humans who are unable to see what is looming right there before them, sitting right before their senses, before their eyes, their ears, their scent, their nose. If they would just believe and in their imagination just imagine for a moment that it was there, this massive creature, they could reach out and touch it with their senses of touch. They could touch the rich textures of its hide, its unknown hide, enlarging their mind, its strangeness beyond their imagination. And they would expand their imagination by having that experience. And yet so many do not reach out to touch it because they cannot believe, cannot conceive of it. And yet they cannot sense it. They cannot see it. They cannot hear it. They cannot smell it. They cannot touch it. Yet often it is the most touchable of things, the most seeable of things, the most hearable of things. The scent of it would be rich. Yet their imagination has failed them, and so their senses go numb.
because they cannot imagine that something so strange and magnificent is there, right there before them. Their imagination cannot encompass it, cannot ingest it, no matter how solid it is, or huge it is, or magnificent or terrible it is. Now, you know I'm a Catholic. When I talk about ingesting the unimaginable and expanding our imagination to know that it is indeed not bread, not wine, but the body and blood of Christ, of God, of the intimate spousal relationship of God and man. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about simple reality, such as a reality of millions of peasants being starved in the Ukraine in the 40s by the Soviets. And yet, even though we knew a little about it, our imagination could not imagine such a terrible thing. To clean out an area of human beings, to cleanse it of human beings, so that there would be vast number of acres of wonderful grain to be grown for the people of the rest of Russia. People had to eliminate them. We could not imagine anybody would do anything so awful, so we denied it and laughed at the people that told us about it. Do you know what you'll find if you go to the literature of the time, written by East European dissidents and exiles? They were struck by one recurrent theme: their amazement, indignation, and anger in the face of the stupidity, ignorance, and indifference of Western opinion, and especially of the Western intellectuals. Indifference. Western intellectuals remained largely incapable of registering the reality of their predicament. It didn't register. They could not imagine it. The Western incapacity to grasp the Soviet reality in all its Asian variants was not a failure of information. Information was always plentiful. It was a failure of imagination. That's the simple and terrible, far more mundane reality and truth that I'm speaking of. No, I'm not speaking of the Eucharist, although it does apply. People who are not capable of imagining that it is the body and blood of Christ will never understand that it is, will never touch it, never feel on Sunday morning the wine, which is Christ's blood, descend within our body and clasp our inmost heart and soul in a deeply affectionate embrace. The tissues of God's body, Christ, God's body, the tissues will kiss the tissues of our human body. The kiss, the embrace, the spousal embrace of the Eucharist and all of us. But so many cannot imagine it, and so they reject it, they deny it. It's not so, it's not so. It's beyond imagination. Oh, really? The Eucharist happens over and over, at every moment of every day somewhere on earth, over and over, just as human tragedies do, that I was referring to, unsensed, unimagined. In the 30s and 40s in this country, there was such immense denial about the truth about the Soviet Union. We used to write articles praising the Soviet Union, praising Stalin, oh, and especially praising the fascist in Italy. His name was Benito Mussolini, and he was the hero of our intellectual elite and our artistic elite. He was our hero, and the fascists in Germany. He was viewed very favorably. Believe it or not, he really was viewed very favorably. So many people in our own country thought that Hitler was finally doing the good thing that needed to be done. Finally, we're organizing society in a way that is going to benefit everybody. So they praised Mussolini. Cole Porter's song, "You're the Top, You're Mussolini." Yes, it's in that Broadway musical's lyrics. There were those that spoke up in an early warning about the real nature of Hitler and fascism, Nazism. One of the very first was Pope Pius XII in a letter to the New York Times, telling the terrible truth. And Pope Pius XII's letter was brought to the attention of Hitler. And Hitler exacted a terrible revenge upon the Catholics of Europe. But wait, didn't we notice the far greater number of victims persecuted under communism, Soviet communism, Chinese communism? Some of us noticed. It was occasionally reported upon, but didn't comprehend, didn't understand. The majority of people did not understand. They could not imagine that the great socialist experiment of the 20th century, so greatly praised, so protected by the academia in this country, by the journalists in this country, the socialist revolutions would produce 80 million victims, innocents, while we in this country paid little attention and even praised Stalin, even praised Mao Zedong. In his number one rated show on Sunday night, Bishop Sheen would point it out and talk about communism for what it was. So it wasn't as if people didn't know. I used to listen to Bishop Sheen as a boy. Life is Worth Living, the number one show on TV. The facts were there, but comprehension was not. The full measure of the truth was so huge that it was not comprehended by so many people. People whose eyes were filled with stars. Their eyes were not filled with real stars. They were filled with glitter. They had imagined small things. Small things. But they didn't really deploy their imagination to encompass reality, to perceive reality. This is why truth can be found through poetry. Because it occupies a much larger realm that would fit in what we imagine as rational. With imagination in poetry, we don't so much as observe reality and describe reality. With the poetic imagination, we, you and I, we lift reality to our lips, to our lips, to our lips, and drink it, and drink it. Then we see what is there. The rational is too often the prisoner of an old concept, the prisoner of an emotion that has no basis in fact. It is when the mind is set free by imagination that it can leap from that confinement and see something that cannot be seen with senses, none of our senses. Sometimes it's a truth that we are not allowing our senses to see. And you know, you think about Pontius Pilate. He knew the truth about Christ. He knew that Christ was not guilty. Pontius Pilate repeated it several times. I can find no fault with this man. But the mob demands his death. And we read in the gospel that Pilate was more afraid than ever. Pilate is scared. He's a professor about to lose his chair. He does not want to have once again a riot on his hands. Should this happen, it would be the end of his career. Pilate's problem was not how to assess Jesus' innocence. This was easy enough to him. It was obvious Jesus was innocent. No, the real problem was that, in the end, like all of us most of the time, lamentably most of the time, Pilate found it more expedient to wash his hands of the truth. And the science of today, lamentably most of the science of today, washes its hands of the truth. So this applies not only to scientific thinking, but also to philosophical thought. Ascending into this realm of thought, let me give you three brief quotations. The first one is by a painter, the second by a philosopher, and the third one is by a poet. First, the painter, Edgar Degas, the Impressionist, said, "In art, truth is suggested by false means." Then the philosopher, George Santayana, "Truth is only believed when someone has invented it well." And the last by the poet, Les Murray, "To think clearly in human terms, you have to be impelled by a poem." Someone once said that everything begins in poetry and ends up in politics. I guess I could modify that to say everything begins in poetry, and some of it ends up as science. Oh, wait a minute. I left out a quote from a politician about truth. Let's see. I like Churchill's. He said, "Men occasionally stumble over the truth, but most of them pick themselves up and hurry off as if nothing had ever happened." I want to say as my final thought here. If we approach science as a strictly rational discipline, you can use a scientific method. You can achieve certain things. But do you distort what you observe, like in the Heisenberg principle? Do you move and change your things by observing it in a direction that you desire? There's something else required. There are higher faculties required. We could call it conscience. But there's something else in there, in the area of imagination and poetry. So yes, we need to practice the earthbound rationality. But our conclusions must not be governed by rationality alone. More important is the process of selection. Our conclusions cannot be selected by rationality alone. We need to apply the higher functions, the spiritual functions, the poetic, the imaginative functions, and beyond that, the sense that we are bathed in the sight of God and must be honest and self-effacing and humble in the face of a mystery and willing to say, this we know, but all of these mysteries are things we do not know. They are mysteries composed of things we do not know. We must have the imagination to grasp how small we are, how very small we are. I hope that more than setting the record straight today, I've also opened up the record, opened up the book of what is real and what is true. This is breadboxmedia.com. May God bring you peace and light. Chuck Coughlin.